right, we're going to go ahead and get started. Welcome. I am Amy Hoyt. I am a professor at the University of the Pacific. And we're going to have a fun conversation, as you can tell. You are in masculine, feminine, and Mormon identity. So let me just introduce the panelists. We have Matthew Despain, who is a professor of history and the director of Native American Studies at Rose State College and the former editor of the Journal of Chickasaw History and Culture. We also have Boyd J. Peterson, who is the program coordinator for Mormon Studies at Utah Valley University and the former editor of Dialogue. Taylor Petrie is the associate professor of religion and the chair of the religion department at Kalamazoo College. And then our respondent is Stacy Lee Ford, and she is associate professor in history and American studies at Hong Kong University.
All right, as I've told everybody, I just get so nervous, right? So I'm just gonna shake it out, and if I faint, then you've got tasks. Okay, I appreciate that. This is my first MHA, so I'm really excited. It's been just a wonderful experience. People have just been just absolutely wonderful, and I grew up in Orms, so it's kind of like coming home a little bit, but anyway, so let's get into it. So my topics I've got up here is with blood in her tracks and meat like rawhide, Lakota Mormon and military masculinities in the beginning of the U.S. Lakota hostile relations. That's a mouthful. Let me see. Let's go ahead and just click that to the next one. And we're just going to leave it up there because I don't have pictures of these guys. They're before photographs and such. So we'll get into it. What I want to do, and the focus of my paper is, as I've told some others here, it's not exclusively Mormon. There's certainly going to be Mormons are key players in this, but they're not. It's not that focused. So I'm going to kind of bring them in on it. My research here is going to look at the Grant Massacre, which has been well written on, and Eli Paul's got a couple books. Just a few months ago, his "It's All About a Mormon Cow" came out, but it was just a collection of reminiscences, right? And so it's a well documented. And was that my phone that did that? And I'd scold my students, you know. But it's a well-documented conflict, but I wanted to take a look at it in a different way. A little front story on this is that it was about 15 years ago, my dad, right, and I grew up in Orem, and I'm visiting him, and he goes, "Matt, you got to come see this great document I found, you know, doing family history." I pull it out. It's just reminiscence from relative generations back, did the Pioneer Trek, and I'm reading it, and I'm going, okay, this is pretty boring. I've read a million of these. And then goes, and we found out that the cow got shot by Indians. I went, "Dad, holy smokes, we now just put a name on who lost the cow." So my shirt tail relatives are the cause of the entire Sioux Plains War, so I have to thank you very much. So the guy's name was Lars Domgaard. Everybody knew it was just a Danish caravan, but now it said our cow. So I'm like going, okay, which had a better legacy, but we'll go with that. Anyway, so again, that got me going 15 years ago, and it's just getting sitting out there, and I finally decided to do something for the conference, right, and jump into this and force me to do this. So again, what I want to do is take a look at this idea of colliding masculinities. So we've got, and it's going to be the actions and the behaviors and the processes that go on in a Lakota world, in a Mormon world, and in a hyper-masculine military world. And because when this conflict erupts, it's not based on policy. It just happens, right? It's not like we'll see with the Little Bighorn or the Rosebud Battlefield or the Wagon Box. Or it's instantaneous. And I look at it, I'm like, oh my gosh, it's a bunch of masculinity colliding in various ways and misunderstandings. So that's where I want to take this. So the three key players are going to be Conquering Bear, who I'll talk about in just a second here, John L. Granton, freshly minted from West Point, and Lars Domgaard, which I've already mentioned to you. You know, and he's one of the new Danish immigrants. He's on the trail in 54, of course, just converted in 51. And it's so, again, taking a look at these three, what's important, as I was looking more closely at this, was I felt like each one of these people were finding themselves in masculine worlds that were in a lot of instability or movement. For instance, Conquering Bear. A key figure within the Brule tribe, right? He was a shirt wearer, a peace advocate. He was a pipe bearer, oversaw the things that went on within the encampment, things of this nature. So he's a guy that had risen up the ranks. But what happens in the Horse Creek Treaty of 51? That's why I've got this map up here, and there's the map created by Father DeSmet up in the corner, and this is kind of a modern look at it. And what were these, basically these indigenous, these Indian lands, right? This treaty finally said, okay, this is where you will be Lakota, this is where you will be Crow, this is where you'll be, we want to stop this conflict along the trails and things of this nature. I don't know, can we? It may have been a bad slide I pulled, so we're all going to have to just squint. Like if I wasn't wearing my, that's the best I've got, so I apologize. But what happened in the Horse Creek Treaty of 51, again, standing a conquering bear is made by the agent to be the chief over all the Lakota. Nothing ever like this has happened, which means he's got new duties and responsibilities, and he's got to keep peace amongst other tribes and the Lakota and amongst the caravans. So his masculine world is being upset very greatly in what his duties and responsibilities are. So those are the kind of things that I was starting to take a look at, was how are, you know, these worlds that are in a tumultuous moment, how are they, you know, creating this instability where the collision, therefore, does occur. So let me kind of get into what I want to do is take a look at kind of the events. Again, you could kind of read these in any book that says, okay, this is what happened, this is what happened. But it's then I want to take a look at what's the masculine component, right? So this starts off, we've got the Danish immigrant or migrant caravan under Hans Olsen, right? And they're going past Fort Laramie. We've got all the Lakota, various bands, Minikoju, Oglala, Brule, they've come to encamp because they're to receive their treaty annuities based on the 51 treaty, on the Horse Creek Treaty. So they're all gathering and waiting and waiting and waiting, right? Grass is getting eaten up, food's getting eaten up, places getting kind of stanky, right? And the Mormons come piling through. And at that moment, this lame cow, as Marie Sandals would say, that was my title, you know, with meat like rawhide, and I can't remember, I get the clamp, right, and I can't remember my own title, right, and meat like rawhide, right, the story goes is it wanders out of the herd, and this young Minikoju by the name of High Forehead shoots it, takes it into his encampment. The Mormon complains about this at Fort Laramie, you know, and so the questions begin to go, okay, why the complaint over a cow that was almost dead anyway, right? Just, you know, High Forehead was kind of doing the cow a service, right? But this triggers what's going to become, we call it the Grant Massacre. I prefer the Grant Fight because, you know, we love to use the word massacre when Indians do it, but we like to use fight when we do it, you know? So I'd like to retitle this the Grant and Fight, right? So this is what's happening, and so let me kind of get into this in a little bit more reading detail, right? So there are some conflicting versions of the killing of the cow. Lakota, I would say, it was lame, it stumbled into our camp, things of this nature. The Mormons would say, oh no, it ran away, and then they shot it for fun, right? So we definitely see different ideas about what really happened, so we'll never know the absolute truth. But when High Forehead killed this cow, one of the things you got to understand is he's doing this within a masculine Lakota world. Okay, number one, it's hunting, right? That's a man thing to do, right? But more important, what he does is he takes that cow, he takes it back into the encampment, and he divides it and he shares it. This is generosity. This is one of the four key principles of a Lakota male. It's right up there with warring, being a warrior, generosity, taking care of the elders and things of this nature. So he's fulfilling his roles as a Lakota male, right? So that triggers things, that things are going. Now Conquering Bear. Conquering Bear hears about this, he goes, oh, I gotta be the peace advocate, I gotta go to the fort, I gotta deal with this, because there's been a stank about it. So he, as I mentioned, goes to Fort Laramie. Again, he's a peace chief, he's a shirt wearer and things of this nature, and he begins the negotiations. They're trying to bring a resolution to this. Now he's not the only one, there's other Brule headmen that are going with him, but he's the one that's recognized as the key leader. And to maintain peace, as required now by his new calling, if we want, well, that's a Mormon term, by his new calling, right? As his lead chief, he offers compensation, his own horses, to replace the cow. And he tries this one horse, two horse, more. There is no acceptance of this compensation. Now, I will say this. The Mormons have moved on. This is all about now him and the military and Concrete Bear. And what the military is wanting to do is go ahead and make an issue out of this. They want to assert their dominion over the Lakota. They want to assert their sovereignty within the Lakota sovereign world. So this is what's going on here. But I come back to it. Conquering Bear is trying to fulfill his obligations as a male in this way. Now that brings us to the post, right? The soldiers at Fort Laramie. And the post commander is a man by the name of Second Lieutenant Hugh B. Fleming. Now he's not the key figure here, but he's dealing with his own masculine problems. And he's got this young upstart, freshly minted West Point cadet that has just been sent to Fort Laramie. And that guy's name, of course, is John L. Granton, John L. Granton, who's wanting to make a name for himself. He wants to get a commission, would love to get back east where he's from. He's from New Hampshire. And so he's pressing Fleming. I want to go out there. I want to do this. To the point, and Conquering Bear's always going, let's just chill. Let's let the agent come. Let's figure this out. Let's have a cooling off period. But Granton keeps pushing Fleming and pushing him to the point that Fleming acquiesces to Granton and basically says, all right, you go ahead and you take your troops, take 29 or so, and you can basically deal with the situation as you see fit. And so he's going to ride out and arrest High Forehead, the one that shot the cow. I'm going to arrest this kid over shooting the cow that nobody cares about anyway. Right. So there we go. Now we've got to explore Granton just for a minute. So Granton's actions, I would say, derive from a self-made American manhood idea that we understand developed during the 19th century, a sense of racial superiority and things of this nature connected to it. Men forged their identity and their status through individual achievement, not from community or inheritance for the most part in this era. So ambition, combativeness, aggressiveness, this is what drove the logic of men of the day to assert their superiority, especially in a hyper-masculine military world, as I would argue. And so what we got going on is within this military life, martial virtues and this competitive impulse, the idea of they're stimulating this idea of the cult of manhood, where you can now through courage and strength and duty and sacrifice and bold and decisive and even violent action, make a name for yourself. And so that's what Granton wants to do. He wants to shape an identity for himself, make a name for himself. And he was quite the braggart. Almost the moment he showed up at Fort Laramie, just a few months before, he's like going, give me a handful of guys, I can go through the Sioux Nation. He would get in the face of other Lakota and just raise his fist like, I'll get you. You know, he was always taunting and pushing and saying these kind of things. And as he's leaving the post that day, he just says, hope to God that we will have a fight. So he's looking for it, right? In the aftermath, after, you know, he gets annihilated, but in the aftermath of the investigation, Major O.F. Winship, Assistant Adjutant General, said this about Granton, because he had known Granton, he said this. Granton was compelled to seek and take by force, if need be, the offender, or submit to the mortification of retiring without having accomplished the objective of his mission. And rather than do this, he resolved to enter the Brule camp and take the Indians at all hazards. So what we have to understand is fear of failure is driving this masculine impulse that he cannot look anything different than what he's been bragging to be. So there we are. He's heading off into the encampment. Now what's happened is near the Brule encampment, as he's heading out, he picks up an interpreter by the name of Lucian Augusta. And he's an interpreter. He's married to a Lakota woman, but he detests Lakota. He's often getting drunk. And in fact, he's inebriated when he's picked up to go be this interpreter. And one of the things that he's doing is he's lobbing insults at the Sioux. We're coming, you women. We will come and conquer you. But he's using this concept of describing them as women. Now, in the Lakota world, right, that's one thing that you don't do. That's a call to fight, right? Because what you're saying is you should be scraping hides. You should be suckling your infants. You should not be out here with us. And so this is just it's common within the Plains societies to do this. But it really is a call for conflict. So he's, because of his idea of what he's trying to project and ideas of not being womanly from a Lakota perspective, this is just infuriating and fanning the flames. Well, near the Brule encampment, Grant enrests his troops. He calls Conquering Bear to come and meet one last parley, and they're parleying while they're going on this. Now, as a peace chief, again, he's trying to soothe the situation. He offers a mule. He offers more, hoof stock to try to appease this, but Granton will have none of it. He wants high forehead. He wants to arrest him. He wants to assert his authority. Again, his jurisdiction in a Lakota world. The map is very clear who has jurisdiction, and the Lakota have jurisdiction. They're letting the Americans be there to pass through, but they really have the sovereignty of the area. But Granton doesn't see that. So again, he's asking for high forehead. Look, Conquering Bear, if he wanted to, he could sue the situation and go, here, take high forehead, whatever, right? Let's not escalate this, but he can't. His duties and responsibilities as that leader, as a man, he cannot. One thing is, high forehead is Minicosu. He is not Brule. He has no jurisdiction over this man. He's a visitor in his encampment. Number two, he can't, in good conscience, give that up. That would say that they have authority over you. It's just impossible for him. That would be an indictment upon his honor and upon his leadership. So, he's in this situation. And he's trying to tell Grant, look, I can't do this. You don't get it. I cannot give this man up. You know, let's just take the horse and let's be done with it. Grant's not happy. So what he does is he goes ahead and he enters into... Oh, we're five. Okay, we're doing it. So he enters into the encampment and begins harder parleys and demanding. And in essence, what Conquering Bear finally has to do, now he's taking his troops into the encampment, he's taking cannons in the encampment, these two are going at it, and finally Conquering Bear is like, what the hell with you? We're done. Oh, sorry. We're done with you guys. Right? We're done with this discussion. And he says something to the effect, and this is what Man Afraid of the Horse says, something to the effect of, this lieutenant is about as worthless to talk to as that cow is lame, or something to that effect, right? He's recognizing this is a futile situation. And so he eventually turns his back and walks away. Understand the discussion's not going to happen. And that infuriates Grant, and Grant goes ahead, and his hypermasculinity orders the encampment to be shot on. Now, I know I'm taking some components out there, but he orders his troops to fire, the cannons to fire, and in that moment, he mortally wounds Conquering Bear, who is the creation by the United States as the key peace advocate. You just assassinated your chief advocate for peace. Oglala and Brule have been sneaking up the river bottoms. They pounce on the detachment and kill everybody, Granton and everybody to the T. So this is where we're at, right? And this becomes the spark for the Sioux Plains Wars. After this, it's policy driven. We'll see the attack on Blue Creek. A post-Civil War, it will become, the whole campaigns on the southern, on the Northern Plains and the Southern Plains. So this is the ignition for the Sioux Plains Wars over a dang cow, right? And as I would argue, over masculinity. Now we've got to get to my 5 minutes, four. Okay, where do we got that? I'm blind, right? Okay, three. Oh, shoot. Okay, so let's go in. I'm going to have to move really quick here, and I'll read a few things. But let's return to the Mormon players, right? The front end of this and the story at that front end and what's going on here. Of course, meets more what we've got to deal with in this conference, and I got 3 minutes to do it. All right. So the question is, why did the Mormons press the issue over this lost cow? Why did they stop off at Fort Laramie? Why did they do this, right? I think I grabbed the wrong page here. So we want to go ahead and take a look at that. Given the cow's condition, like I said, what High Forehead had done was really mostly an act of mercy on this, less an opportunity. So the answer that we've got to give ourselves, or that I'm at, what's the answer to my question, is that why press this issue? Why is it that Lars Domgaard is making an issue out of this cow? Yeah, it's worth maybe $25 to $40 in that day's market value, but they've got probably 300 head that they're moving. Why the issue over this? And as I come back to it, stewardship. All this to build up to stewardship. I'm sorry, guys, but I'll move really quick here. But stewardship, and what I start to argue in this is that these saints, as they're going westward, this is what I think really influences this masculinity, duty and responsibility upon the trail. Now I'm going to have to get away from what I taught, all this stuff I wrote down here, just hit the high points. But there definitely is this idea that men's responsibility on the trail, and there's a lot said about cattle responsibility. Brigham Young even says that the cows are the Lord's cows and that he is the boss of the plains and that there are rules set up in the caravans that you need to watch over your cows. You need to make sure that they get to the Great Basin. In fact, there's shortages of cattle in the Great Basin. This is about building up that stock. And there's been a lot of loss of cattle on the trail that year of 54. So I think there's a lot of pressure on Lars Dumgaar to fulfill his responsibility to take care of his property as defined within stewardship, because it really is all the Lord's property. And so at that point, is that my ding to get done? Oh, okay. So this is what I think compels him to do this, right? Look, it's a climate of intense, there's a lot of intense rhetoric about this idea of stewardship and such. I mean, Orson Pratt and the Seers talking about this very heavily in those years. We see it in some of the Danish publications for the saints. They're talking about this issue of, you know, you really need to fulfill your responsibility. So I think when Lars Dumgaar and the Danish saints really head westward, they are really compelled by this fulfilling a destiny. You know, what was it that Wallace Stegner said? Something in effect that, you know, this overland migration, I'm paraphrasing him, this overland migration was the thing that really proved your worth, you know, this trial by fire, by this journey. Well, if you're failing in this journey, this trial by fire, then where are you? And I think this plays upon Lars Dumgaar. I've got to sustain my good standing in the caravan, my good standing in the church. I got to take care of my property, because if not, then I'm failed. You know, if you're a failed man within the church and you're failed within the priesthood, you know, I'm kind of stretching things a little bit, but, you know, what's your potential identity, callings, power, things of this nature? And so I think this is what compels him to go and make a stink over a lame cow that is, you know, again, nearly dead, and then shift the blame not upon himself but upon the Lakota, because they were the Lamanites, the loathsome people that went ahead and killed this for sport. I didn't lose it. They killed it for sport. And so I hear the dings. I know. So I'm going to go ahead and wrap that up. And the beauty of this is going to be a bigger project where I'm taking a look at all three of these individuals and in a kind of more of a book manuscript that I want to do and bring them to this moment of conflict. And the beauty is everybody dies, right? Look, Granton dies, Conquering Bear, and that's what makes a good story when everybody dies, right? So Granton dies, Conquering Bear dies, and Lars Dumgaar dies, not because of what happens with the Indians, but he gets to Emigration Canyon, and he's coming down the canyon, and his brother rides out for Manti to greet him, and he dies one day before his brother gets there. I'm like, going, this is perfect. This is going to be my award-winning book. So anyway, there you go. I'm going to go ahead and say...
Well, I can't follow that one. There's no cows in this story. Let's start with the beginning. Genesis records only three sentences of dialogue from Eve. Her words to the serpent, which she repeats and slightly modifies from God's prohibition about eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, her response to God that the serpent beguiled her, and her announcement of Cain's birth, "I have gotten a man from the Lord." Mormon scripture gives Eve another line of dialogue. In his 1830 revisions to the book of Genesis, Smith not only provided a fortunate fall, he Christianized the text by adding a post-lapsarian scene in which the angel instructs Adam and Eve about Christ's atonement. And following that, Adam rejoices about the future generations, and then Eve glories in the good news and says, "Were it not for our transgression, we should never have had seed and never should have known good and evil, and the joy of our redemption and the eternal life which God giveth unto all obedient." Then together Adam and Eve blessed the name of God, and they made all things known unto their sons and daughters. Additionally, the text notes that after being cast out of Eden, Eve did labor with Adam. So Joseph Smith not only gave Eve more words than she had in Genesis, he shows her as an eloquent theologian and an equal partner to Adam. Now, with these revisions, Eve's traditional status as temptress and scapegoat is significantly altered. Nevertheless, that status has evolved from a guilt-ridden pawn who unintentionally accomplishes God's will, to one who chose knowingly with heroic vision to bring about human potentiality. LDS women have led out in revitalizing Eve's status, typically in response to the larger American discourse about suffrage in the 19th century and equal rights in the 20th. And contemporary male church leaders now speak of Eve with the same rhetorical and theological majesty that women used in the 19th century. Yet differences remain in the ways church leaders and individual LDS women discuss Eve. Institutional discourse about Eve is typically prescriptive, holding Eve up as a model of womanhood, while women's personal lived religious descriptions of Eve often reflect their deepest longings, concerns, joys, and sadness. Furthermore, institutional discourse typically isolates LDS women from the rest of the world, while individual discourse tends to integrate them back into it. So before I go into the Mormon stuff, I just want to emphasize that Eve-based misogyny is not new to Mormonism. In fact, it isn't even based on Eve. The history of this goes back even further. Prudence Allen has a wonderful collection of books called The History of Woman. And in there, she takes it all back to Aristotle and argues that Aristotle provided the foundation for the systematic advancement of knowledge in Western culture, but also for the intellectual roots of theories that distorted women's identity for millennia to come. So Aristotle, for one thing, he believed that they had a very strange conception of how humans are conceived. Women provide the matter out of which humans are made, and men provide the form. And our words father and mother actually come from that. So pater, familius, right, pattern, and mater, mother, they come from the same roots. So we end up with a kind of this kind of taxonomy of gender roles that goes back to Aristotelian logic, where women are the passive side of things, men are the active side, men are reasonable, women are ruled by passions, men have good judgment, women are deceived, men rule, women obey, the public sphere is for men, the domestic sphere for women. And then we add on to that something that goes back for a long time, this notion that, bad theology further contributed to these roles from the time of the Jewish philosopher Philo of Alexandria in the first century and Augustine of Hippo in the fourth, well into the Middle Ages, the common interpretation of Genesis 1:26, where God proposed, "Let us make man in our own image after our likeness," was that he created man in the image of God, whereas woman was created in the image of man. So being both corporeal and woman, Eve was two steps removed from God, whereas Adam was only one. So I'm going to skip a bunch here, but the 19th century brought a lot of rethinking about notions of original sin, and new conceptions of Eve came about through new religious traditions. But perhaps one of the most radical reimaginings of Eve was the Woman's Bible, which was produced by, was spearheaded by Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Stanton was particularly interested in repairing Eve's image. She kind of did a very similar thing to what Thomas Jefferson does to the Bible. She kind of cut and pasted things she liked, things she didn't like. Noting the existence of two creation stories, she argued that the first account by the priestly author was truly egalitarian, male and female he created them, and more in harmony with natural laws and science. The second account she passed off as the work of a wily writer who, seeing the perfect equality of man and woman in the first chapter, felt it important for the dignity and dominion of man to affect women's subordination in some way. Both Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony spent a week visiting Utah in 1871 and established close ties with Mormon suffragists. Likewise, LDS Relief Society President Emmeline Wells addressed them on multiple occasions back at the National Woman Suffrage Association in Washington, D.C. And soon after the publication of the Women's Bible, the LDS periodical Woman's Exponent published excerpts from Stanton's commentary, And one of the pieces that they noted that particularly resonated to them was where Stanton says, God created man in his own image, male and female, where she comments on that and says, if language has any meaning, we have in these texts a plain description of the existence of the feminine element in the Godhead, equal in power and glory with the masculine, the heavenly mother and father. So Mormon women didn't end up producing a women's Bible, but they were in dialogue with this larger culture and recognized in their own ideology these tools for kind of reimagining the role of Eve. I'm going to skip some more here. But aside from that one, the changes in the scripture, Joseph Smith didn't have a whole lot to say about Eve. There's a wedding that he does that's based on Eve. And there's a reported vision that he has, but it's very late and probably embellished account by Zebedee Coltrane. But Brigham Young has quite a bit to say, and not a lot of it is very positive. Occasionally he'd say things like, Mother Eve had a splendid influence over Adam, and he praised her for getting Adam to take the forbidden fruit. But he also supported these very strong gender roles. So it is the calling of the wife and mother to labor to make her home desirable for her husband and children, making herself an Eve in the midst of a little paradise of her own creating. This was a particular emphasis in the 19th century. Mormons tended to focus on this idea of a curse, and the idea of redemption often was talked about, or restoration was often talked about in terms of the redemption of Adam and Eve. So for 19th century Mormons through early 20th century, a lot of the kind, I think this quote from James Talmadge really summarizes a lot of their thoughts. Our first parents are entitled to our deepest gratitude for the legacy to posterity, the means of winning title to glory and exaltation in eternal life. However, he stresses that Eve fulfilled the foreordained purpose of God, but she did not partake of the forbidden fruit with that object in view, but with the intent to violate the divine command, being deceived by the sophistries of the serpent fiend. So Eve accomplished this thing, but she didn't do it on purpose, so there was no purposeful reason. Back in, I think I've got these slides reversed. Oh, maybe I don't have a slide for this one. Yeah, I don't. So George Q. Cannon addressed specifically the Woman's Exponent piece where they published Stanton's work, and in that, he said, he criticized the idea that Heavenly Mother was part of the Godhead. He says, there was no revelation of the feminine element as part of the Godhead, and no idea was conveyed that any such element was equal in power and glory with the masculine, which is a quotation from the Woman's Bible. Therefore, we are warranted in pronouncing all tendencies to glorify the feminine element and to exalt it as part of the Godhead is wrong and untrue, not only because of the revelation of the Lord in our day, but because it has no warrant in Scripture, and any attempt to put such a construction on the Word of God is false and erroneous. A few years ago, I published an article, and I'm just going to summarize a few bits from this because it kind of fits into the timeline, where I looked at the Woman's Exponent and the kind of dialogue that women were having. I just want to mention a few things that came out of that. So women tended to be looking in very different ways at Eve than their male leaders. A lot of women saw Eve as E.H. Lyon revered Eve as the finishing touch of the Almighty. Sarah Kimball wrote, our great maternal progenitor is entitled to a reverent honor for braving the peril that brought Earth's children from the dark valley of ignorance and stagnation and placed them on the broad progressive plane where they knowing good and evil. Zina D.H. Young makes this comment about how it was. You have to also understand that at that time, Brigham Young's theology about Adam God was common, right? And so Adam was God. And so then Eve was his wife, right? God's wife. And so a lot of women anticipated the idea that they would become an Eve on their own planet. Now, Brigham Young didn't think that Adam had only one wife, but evidently one wife per planet. So that was kind of the way they worked it. So a lot of women kind of looked forward to this idea of, you know, having their own planet one day, men having multiple, I guess. As Samuel W. Richards said, to be the mother of all living is an office, which he published in a piece in the Exponent. Eve was also used to defend polygamy, curiously enough, even though there's no account of there being another wife, unless you count Lilith, who's in the folklore, but never in the scripture. And so Mormon women constantly were doing that. A lot of women were using Eve as a model of domesticity. There was a universal acceptance of this Victorian idea of the separate spheres, men having their sphere and women having their sphere, which again dates back to Aristotelian times. But there was often some kind of interesting playfulness with this. So compare this with Brigham Young's quote, "The domestic sphere is, of course, the theater of woman's particular role, but did God intend her to be the domestic drudge? Toil is not mentioned as Eve's curse. That was especially man's punishment." She went on to criticize the fact that men are always trying to make their work easier, but they don't seem to care about the fact that women's work is supposed to never change. So with the embracing the fortunate fall, LDS theology reduced, if not immediately overturned, Eve's culpability. The post-lapsarian curses, however, were another matter. According to Genesis, when Adam and Eve were expelled from the garden, God pronounced a curse upon them and the serpent. The serpent, of course, is cursed to crawl on his belly, Adam to till from the earth with thistle and thorn, and Eve's curse consists of three parts. Typically, we only think of it as two, but 19th century Mormon women certainly didn't. The curse that that birth pains would be severe, that she'll be ruled by her husband, and that her desire will be to him. And the curse, the part of the curse that they seem to really focus in on is in this part about the desire of the husband, which of course with polygamy would be very difficult. So some women postulated that they would overcome the curse through suffrage. Some thought through using natural health care. Probably people who are now progenitors are probably running Nu Skin. But a lot of them thought that they would remove the curse by living polygamy, which is really fascinating, right? There's a kind of poignant, aching cognitive dissonance in that kind of theology, that by living this doctrine that would make the attachment to your husband more difficult, you're also going to remove the curse, right? So this is George Q. Cannon's quote, where he says, "If practiced in virtue and purity, plural marriage will exalt woman until she is redeemed from the effects of the fall." And again, this is something women bought into. You see this throughout the Woman's Exponent, which is really kind of interesting. I want to look at a kind of institutional sea change that happened at the dawn of the 20th century. So probably the first step is Joseph Fielding Smith, who has a vision. And this vision, he speaks with a kind of rhetorical zeal that 19th century men didn't speak with, but 19th century women did. So he talks about our glorious Mother Eve, which again is very typical of 19th century women's discourse, but not for men. But again, there's a kind of, it's a rhetorical flourish, but it isn't a theological flourish. Now, women, Eve is not talked about in general conference for quite a while right here. And that's kind of an interesting little dip. And if you compare it to how she's talked about with Adam, it's an even more sizable dip. So there's a kind of interesting way that General Conference doesn't seem to really illustrate the concerns of women. There is a notable exception in the 20th century by J. Reuben Clark, who's the first counselor to then-President George Albert Smith, where he gave a talk in the Relief Society Conference in 1946. And the talk veered between kind of a reverence for Eve and a really strange kind of sexism. Oh, my goodness. And so I'll just put the quote up there. Well, I don't have the quote. Darn it. He talks about the radiant, divinely fair, the last created being, so this kind of rhetorical zeal that he uses. But then he talks about how she's under the priesthood, and the glory of true womanhood is motherhood. So second wave feminism seems to have a huge shift in not only the general public, but in the church. Esther Peterson was in the Kennedy administration. She was a Latter-day Saint. And even though Mormons tended to really worry about second wave feminism, there was a kind of a change in the way Mormon leaders talked about Eve. You have to remember now that the Adam God doctrine, and I'm going to call doctrine because Brigham Young would have called it that, that had been rejected by that time. So the idea of Eve being Heavenly Mother was not there anymore. But there's a kind of shift in theology where men don't want to, the priesthood leaders don't want people to talk about Heavenly Mother, but they seem to be fine with elevating Eve, which is kind of a compensatory thing. And you can note this in Bruce R. McConkie, which is an interesting place to look. So in his first edition of Mormon Doctrine in 1958, he takes this very traditional view that, you know, Eve is still not a great person, even though she did the right thing. But by the 1979, by 1979, he changes his tune. And Joseph Fielding Smith is also saying things that really elevate Eve to a kind of status as making a really purposeful choice. I have some great poetry, but I'm going to skip that. So the thing that I think is interesting is that for LDS leaders today, Eve tends to serve the purpose of, on the one hand, compensating for lack of discussion on Heavenly Mother, but also for preserving very, you know, traditional gender roles. The Parents' Guide is terrific. You've got to look at that sometime, but it compares Adam and Eve. It talks about how girls need to go and look at the arts and housekeeping, domestic finances. Boys need to learn home repair and career preparation and protection of women, because guess what? That's what you're going to be doing in the eternities. I find that funny. The Family Proclamation, of course, talks about the first commandment God gives to Adam and Eve. And again, you get this very interesting dichotomy of fathers presiding, providing, and protecting, women being the nurturers, very similar to the Aristotelian typology that I showed earlier. And so time's up. That's it. I like to think of this as Adam and Eve in Bountiful, Utah.
In 1975, then church president Spencer W. Kimball asked Victor Brown Jr. to write a series of reports on the causes of deviant sexual activities and his recommended cures. Brown, a trained psychologist and the director of the LDS Social Services, spent a year preparing his remarks. When he delivered the report to general authorities in 1976, Brown laid out a theory of sin as symptoms whose causes lay at a deeper level. The report began by quoting 1 Timothy 3:5, "For if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God?" Brown argued that the masculine father was the crucial figure in the family and the key to preventing problems in children, from minor emotional fragility to sexual deviance, especially homosexuality. He was concerned that fathers were neglecting their duty and were prone to falter in their responsibilities. Quote, "The weakest link in the temple ordinance chain is the man, the priesthood holder." He concluded, "The root problem, therefore, is the failure not of mothers, but of fathers to magnify their calling. Delinquent male leadership and sexual deviance were inextricably linked." The impotence for the meeting was just as important as the conclusions. Something new was happening with Brown's presence and influence. This paper follows a competing set of ideologies for thinking about same-sex relationships in the 1970s. Victor Brown Jr., his theories, his psychological theories, were not the only option, but were a new development in the 1970s. These sat side by side with a complementary but ultimately distinctive moralistic theory. Kimball's paradigm for pastoral care had been deeply influenced by 20th century positive thinking movements, from New Thought to the teachings of Norman Vincent Peale in The Power of Positive Thinking and other self-help ideologies, which taught that self-discipline of the mind was the key to success in life. Kimball frequently quoted and recommended self-help guru James Allen's 1903 bestseller, As a Man Thinketh, in his accounts of sin and repentance, believing that the mind could be controlled and shaped to overcome sin. Kimball had begun to appropriate LDS professionals in his assignment to find a solution to what were called homosexual problems. At their invitation, perhaps in early 1964, Kimball addressed a group of LDS psychologists on various sexual maladies. The speech was a significant historical marker. It was the earliest instruction to deal so thoroughly with pastoral approaches to homosexuality and offered some insights into the pathological framework that Kimball was using. He urged the psychiatrists and church leaders to counsel in harmony with the church teachings. Kimball explained to the teachers that they could assist bishops in providing the cure and encourage them to prevent homosexuality as you indoctrinate in the preventative spiritual medicine. With all the talkness of sicknesses, cures, prevention, spiritual medication, treatment, and the comparison of bishops to physicians, Kimball fully accepted the epistemology of medicine to describe his approach to homosexuality. The homosexual was a pathological subject, and church leaders could administer a cure with pastoral care. He advised LDS psychologists and church educators, quote, "The cure for this malady lies in self-mastery, which is the fundamental basis of the whole gospel program." Kimball frankly attested, "We know such a disease is curable. Homosexuality was a disease, and the mind could cure it." Masculinity was an important lens for how Kimball described the causes and cures of homosexuality, revealing the ways that homosexuality was asymmetrically gendered as a male issue. He reported that the practice may be as prevalent among women as it is among men, but he referred almost exclusively to the male offender. "Men have become dejected," he explained. "They have gone out, men who have become dejected," he explained, "have gone out later, ready to manfully take part in society and even in the church on an approved, cured basis." Quoting extensively from Allen's As a Man Thinketh, Kimball questioned the masculinity of someone who could not master himself. But the primary advice for the cure was not focused on gender reconstruction per se. There was no attention to bodily comportment, interests in sports or mechanics, or relationships with the father. Rather, the failure of masculinity was in lack of self-control, not object choice or gender performance. The promotion of the pastoral care model in LDS practices drew on broader Protestant adaptation of psychological models, while also expressing contempt for the competing authority of secular psychologists. This contempt obscured just how much the language, frameworks, and methods of psychology the church was adopting. The therapeutic turn in church counseling was seen as a complement to traditional modes of piety and kept the church's approach to sin relevant at a time saturated with popular psychological perspectives. The combination of religion and therapy brought together powerful narratives of change and transformation, putting forward an optimistic view of humanity built on the mutability of sexual and gendered subjectivity. Self-transformation was salvation, and sex was at the center of this new regulatory ideal. Kimball's 1964 speech was just the beginning of a massive transition of LDS approaches to homosexuality that incorporated professionalized psychological approaches. These psychological approaches increased the emphasis on masculinity and gender norms as deeply connected to homosexuality and expanded the scope of masculine comportment far beyond the moral character trait of self-mastery. In 1969, the Correlation Committee put the Relief Society's social service efforts under the control of the male leaders of the church. When Victor L. Brown Jr. became director of this new agency in 1971, it was then rolled under his father, Victor L. Brown Sr., among others, who was then a counselor in the presiding bishopric. Victor Brown Jr. was a trained psychologist influenced by Freudian theories of the subconscious and depth psychology. Brown believed that homosexuality had deeper emotional causes, which was why pastoral counseling and individual repentance did not always work. Deeper problems required deeper solutions. Brown's theories showed up in the early efforts of the newly reorganized LDS social services. In this view, gender normativity was an important tool for ferreting out who may be involved in homosexuality and in providing a cure. The 1973 instruction book, Homosexuality Welfare Services Packet 1, which indicates the priority that was placed on this in the first LDS social services, is the first thing they produced, reflected Brown's psychological theories that homosexuality was a learned behavior. When seeking to identify suspected homosexuals, the Welfare Services Packet explained, among the more reliable signs are excessive involvement with members of the same sex by those who are physically mature but do not date and who lack interest in marriage. With respect to boys who have rounded hips, slightly enlarged breasts, or feminine voices, and girls who have narrow hips, it advised that the chemical imbalances that cause these mixed physical characteristics do not necessarily cause homosexuality. But the social reactions to these differences may cause the emotional problems that lead to homosexuality. Church leaders were advised to provide social support, including learning what a heterosexual life is and what a manly priesthood leader and father does. This approach to identity and the causes and cures of homosexuality suggested that social and emotional problems led to a blurring of one's identity and desires, most often through a failure to perform the gendered practices one was assigned. Even ambiguous bodies were not seen as a problem, but rather the failure to acquire the proper gender, including heteronormative desires, could be remedied by learning about manliness. Despite official sponsorship, scientific and psychodevelopmental theories of homosexuality still faced some skepticism among the highest-ranking church leaders in the 1970s. They worried that psychodevelopmental theories displaced responsibility away from the individual and undermined agency. These leaders continued to advance moral explanations on the causes of homosexuality to accompany psychological ideas that childhood had been a sexually formative stage. Apostle Boyd K. Packer was a key figure who held this view. His speeches on gender and sexuality in the late 1970s were deeply influenced by Kimball, who was then the president of the church. Like Kimball, Packer adopted pathological language about homosexuality, speculating on its causes and promising a total cure, but remained skeptical about psychological etiologies. Packer did agree with the emergent psychological compatibilism within the church on some issues, that homosexuality was caused in childhood and was a failure of gender norms. But he still believed that emotional conditions were the result of bad habits, not the other way around. In the male-only session of the General Conference on October 2, 1976, Packer delivered a talk to young men only about masturbation. In this speech, Packer refuted the idea of a natural homosexual, explaining, quote, no one is locked into that kind of life. There is no mismatching of bodies and spirits. Boys are to become men, masculine, manly men, ultimately to become husbands and fathers. No one is predestined to a perverted use of these powers. Conflating homosexuality with contemporary ideas about transsexuality Packer insisted that a male homosexual was not a female spirit trapped in a man's body. Young men were especially vulnerable because they, quote, may be tempted to handle one another in idle moments. Packer's view on the causes of male homosexuality was not connected to parental failure, but rather an instability of sexual desires on the way to manhood that could be awakened by masturbation. This fragile moment required extra caution, up to and including physical violence, to protect oneself against it. These brief summaries show that in the 1970s, the 1970s proved to be a crucial turning point in LDS discourse about homosexuality as it came into greater focus. Psychological theories and their relationship to normative masculinity can be traced out of the three different approaches surveyed here. The moralistic theories on the etiology of homosexuality that Kimball put forward focused on the absence of a masculine virtue of self-control. These ideas were connected to broader popular psychology that focused on controlling one's thoughts as a key to emotional and social well-being. Second, the teachings of depth psychology drew on Freudian theories of the unconscious and object choice. This theory believed that a lack of adequate patriarchal presence in the home would lead to gender failure for young men who would not have a proper male role model. Learning the masculine way of life was both a preventative measure against homosexuality as well as a path to a cure for those who needed to develop their masculinity later in life. Finally, Packer offered a merger of the two, seeing childhood as a precarious time for establishing masculinity, but the moralistic teachings about self-control as the primary lens for interpreting that precarity. These competing theories show how LDS leaders' views of homosexuality were deeply shaped by the social and intellectual contexts of the 1970s, especially around dominant discourses about normative masculinity and psychological culture. At the same time, they reveal that these discourses were not monological, but rather open to revision, disagreement, and adaptation. Among the many changes to LDS teachings that took place during this period, church leaders adopted a religio-psychological framework that viewed sexuality broadly in Freudian psychoanalytic terms. In this view, sexuality and object attachment were not innate, but developed in early childhood and adolescence. In fact, the Parent's Guide is a psychodevelopmental theory of sexuality that derives right out of the same material here, 1985. In addition, this framework increasingly identified sexuality in terms of gender, such that the proper performance of maleness and femaleness was deeply connected to heterosexuality, both explaining its presence and providing a path to rectifying any deviations. Thank you.
So it's raining men. Hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
First of all, I want to thank my sister for exercising a little bit of nepotism and letting me comment here. This has been delightful for a number of reasons. And in an MHA meeting where I think there has been an embarrassment of riches in terms of women's, gender, masculinity, and sexuality studies, this panel in particular reminds us, along with other panels that I've had the pleasure of sitting in on and hearing about, reminds us that these fields of inquiry that are being borrowed and referenced here not only speak to LDS experiences, but how Mormon studies has grown up with this sort of theorizing. And I want to flag Amy Hoyt's work, Carolyn Klein's work, there's others in the room, Tana Lynn, who have been thinking about these, and then there's a younger generation that I am just learning about, and it's incredibly exciting. So I want to just quickly flag some common ground that I see between all three of the papers. First of all, they offer grist for further theorizing men's experiences in masculinity studies. And in the work that I'm currently, for years I did women's and transnational feminist studies, and my current project is on men and masculinity in Asian and Asian American contexts, and it's killing me because I'm not a dude. And so I'm reminded, I have what I liked about all these papers, first of all, the written, you heard more of the written word in Taylor's voice than you did the other two, but all three of the papers are woven together elegantly, and you see the layered deployment of feminist masculinity studies, transnational studies in important ways. But my point is, masculinity studies in any context is still under-theorized. And I think Amy's work, somebody said there are five, maybe it was, somebody said there are five articles on Mormon masculinity and a small number of books. So this is a wide open field. Those of you who have been doing this work, I think we look forward to hearing from you in the Q&A and after. But I think there are potentially important theoretical interventions to be made out of all three of these papers that are in conversation with other works in gender, sexuality, and intersectional studies. And all of these papers do that sort of intersectional work that we talk about. And whether you're going to, you know, work with the Crenshaw notion of intersectionality coming out of critical legal studies, or whether you want to think more broadly in terms of what went on in women's history and African American and then later third wave studies, my point is we're looking at gender, racialized gender, and then religious and racialized gender. And so those intersectional approaches are apparent in all of these papers, and it's very exciting. Also, I think all three of the papers attest to gender performativity, the malleability of that. And this is a very key moment because we feel very strongly in terms of LDS theology about gender as an essential characteristic. And what Taylor does in his work is he respectfully and empathically connects the proclamation on the family to Judith Butler. God bless him. He does it in respectful ways. And what I think is fascinating is we're going to teach queer theory in my young single adult Sunday school class in Hong Kong, and it's going to be okay, right? And I think, and the other thing is, as a feminist, he challenged some of my deepest, you know, my most deeply held anger in some respects. It makes me think about patriarchy in different ways. And all three of the papers connect to threads in global Mormon studies. So for those of you, I'm looking at Vina and others who have talked about this at the, already in this conference and at the Global Mormon Studies Breakfast. The work on global masculinity studies in some ways I think is more connected with Mormon masculinity than what I see coming out of Western masculinity or US masculinity studies, but we can talk about all of that as well. So Michael Hearn, in his anthology Men of the World, uses the term trans patriarchy, which is not transsexual patriarchy, it is transnational patriarchy. And he says you need to look at the ways in which different types of authority layer on top of and inform each other. So what Matt is doing in his work is trans patriarchy, and it's really very interesting. So to Matt's work, there are several key terms in his paper, I think, that are very important, and that they connect, I think, with work that I first became aware of with Patricia Nelson Limerick, New Western History, Borderland Studies. So the ways that he connects with Latina feminism as well as New Western history, and then brings masculinity into the picture, is fascinating. So when he talks about the concept of contending masculine worlds, I heard Maria Lugones's discussion of world traveling and playfulness, which I think if you decide you want to like put feminist Latin feminism in conversation. And I want to ask you about where the women are in this picture, because you mentioned that they are the foils. Nobody wants to be a woman. But there was a wife, you mentioned somebody, so I would be interested in knowing, I realize that's not what you're doing here, but in the larger project, I think putting women onto that canvas would be terrific. Also, the concept of maneuvering in the middle ground, I think is incredibly important. The shifting meanings within the middle ground and generation becomes a part of that shift. That speaks to, I think, work those of us who are doing Asia and thinking about diaspora. We can make all those sorts of links about what is happening in those the space between the third space, the middle ground. So. I think he uses a term, Matt uses a term, sorry. These three separate cultures with three distinct systems of masculinity struck together at a precise time and place to spark conflict. And I want to think about the ways in which we could spark other things as well, right? That conflict, he focuses on conflict, but that sort of triangulation or transpatriarchy, whatever you want to call it, could it reformulates masculinity in your paper in a certain way, but it could spark other things as well. He also had a really elegant section on blame and shame and the historical narrative of Lars Domgaard shifting the blame as from, I guess it was from the Sioux, right, there, at that point. So, and it reminded me, you know, men have been in the blame game for a long time, right? Adam, blame Eve. Fake news, right? So just this whole idea of he does this like men blame each other, right? And the Mormon guy going, oh, I didn't want to do this, not my fault, right? And so I thought there's all sorts of the ways in which the differences between and among men are oftentimes as significant or more significant than the differences between men and women. And I think he nicely brings that out as well. And of course the racialization of the blame and of the conflict is very important as well. He touched a little bit with you all on self-made manhood, but I think we are unpacking self-madeness, separate spheres in all of these papers in ways that I think will continue to be important. And I can't talk to you as much, my background is not in religious studies. I am an interested Mormon feminist as opposed to a theologian or a religious studies scholar, but those of you who've been doing this work, I think it's very important to connect those dots as well. To Boyd's work now, and for me, Boyd's work is still very much, he sent me, the document that I read was sprawling in all sorts of really interesting ways. So I'm interested in seeing where this project goes, and I'm going to lobby him to think more about feminist theology, because I think you have some wonderful voices, Latter-day Saint women's voices and the men there. But I was wanting you, when you mentioned Katie Stanton, and by the way, he brings the narrative all the way up to the present in the paper that I saw. So I'm thinking, you know, Elaine Pagels's work, those of you who do feminist theology, raise your hand if you've done work on Eve in this room. So that's, my sense is that is a body of work that he can connect with as well. And I know he's written about this, and I'm not as prepared to comment about that, but I think there's no doubt, I was so delighted to hear the discussion of the Women's Bible in this context, because I think there are all sorts of important textual links, whether it's Aristotelian or Katie Stanton, but I think the text, the ways in which to this day LDS folk use subversive texts or non-conventional texts in all sorts of very conventional ways, or use conventional texts in all sorts of subversive ways, I think his work points that out as well. I loved his discussion of the reverence that we have for Eve, as well as the strange sort of sexism that surrounds our celebration of that. And I think those contradictions we see, they continue today in terms of the way we discuss LDS women over the pulpit. And those contradictions then continue into the discussion that we see with Taylor's paper. For me, you are what we call a male ally. In Hong Kong, we talked about the ways in which the performance of feminist brotherhood was very much present for me in this paper, and I appreciated that a lot. Now, to Taylor, whose book is pretty much finished, so this is a baked publication, I think, right? Pretty much. And so all I have to say is, watch and wait, because I think it's incredibly exciting. But there's an elegant use of interdisciplinary and theoretical analysis in this book that will appeal to a range of readers, and it is not easy to do, to make post-structuralist theory and gender performativity speak to general conference talks. And that's before we get to the feminist psychoanalytic, right? I mean, it is such a rich, rich text. And it's readable. And he was kind enough to let me take a look at the larger work, and I literally stayed up all night, which is why I have glasses on instead of contacts today. I'm going to jump a little bit to some of the other ideas. See, when he talks about soft egalitarianism, companionate patriarchy, that connects to work that Caroline has done, that Melissa Inouye has done, the ways in which when I got to Asia, I had to rethink my feminism. And then that made me look again at women here and thinking about the range of performances of liberation or freedom or whatever you want to call it. But Taylor's work helps us think about the ways in which civil rights, gender and sexuality activism finds its way into leadership practices in the quorum of the 12 and the First Presidency, and that there is this complex compound of opposing feminism even while being influenced by it. And again, that's before we get to the women, and he talks a lot about feminist Mormons, and I'm very curious for me, there, and it's not in this book, I know, but others of you who have done work, the question of where do women like Chieko Okazaki and Aline Clyde, women who took a very careful approach, who were pushing on the inside, but didn't make the same sorts of waves. I think the question of, I don't know that there's a place in this work, but I think he's going to open up all sorts of conversations about women who choose to stay inside an institutional space as well as those who challenge it. And again, many of you are doing work in that space as well. I think his appeals to help us think beyond essentialism are really compelling. And I think I can't say enough about the importance of that. And that he talks to us about a competing set of ideologies for thinking about same-sex relationships, not only in the 1970s, but when he talks about the importance of psychological interventions and models, that continues when he talks about feminism later on, and again, right up into the current period today. The one thing I thought about as I was reading your work is Ethan Waters' work. The title is Crazy Like Us, the Americanization of the Global Psyche. So we're thinking about American psychological interpretations, even though it's Freud, right? It's an Americanized presentation of Freud. And so what does it mean that if we're wanting to think globally, how do these psychological models travel? Which brings us back to the global once again. But I thank all three of you for incredibly rich papers, and I look forward to seeing what comes next. Thanks.